All right, good morning, Sea Mask viewers. Welcome to another episode of Sea Mask with the dudes, Will Nolan, Nick Stumphauser, and Tim Gordon. Good to see you dudes as always. So today I want to talk about, I know this sounds kind of strange, but one of my favorite, or I guess most studied virtues of fortitude. And I suppose the reason for that being, I get, the line of work that I'm in, working with guys, you know, around particular addictions, overcoming lust, leading in their marriages better, fitness, etc. And it kind of always comes back to this virtue. But just in case anybody doesn't know or doesn't know how it's defined, I don't remember where I got this quote, but fortitude is the moral virtue that ensures firmness in difficulties and constancy in the pursuit of the good. It strengthens the resolve to resist temptations and to overcome obstacles in the moral life. The virtue of fortitude enables one to conquer fear, even fear of death, and to face trials and persecutions. It disposes one even to renounce and sacrifice his life in defense of a just cause. The Lord is my strength and my song. In the world you have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I've overcome the world. In a lot of ways, it's the forgotten virtue. It's the guardian of the other virtues, because without it, how can we truly remain faithful and virtuous in the face of chaos? And without it, we're like a house built on straw instead of concrete. And the logical end result of a lack of fortitude is either complete or at best lukewarm faith that runs cold. And so just to quote Saint Ambrose on fortitude, one of the duties of fortitude is to keep the weak from receiving injury, another to check the wrong motions of our own souls, a third both to disregard humiliations and to do what is right with an even mind. All these clearly ought to be fulfilled by Christians and especially by the clergy. So the first sort of question discussion point is sort of this, you know, enjoy the decline, which I think is a cry of a nation of men that have abandoned the idea of, you know, fortitude, mortification, longanimity, et cetera, and bringing in, we're trying to bring light to a doomer worldview. So how do we inspire men to see through the psyop of the black pill, and how can they sort of reclaim a sense of fortitude in a world that we know go right, but the world is telling them to go left, this with regards to their occupation, especially marriage, you know, faith, et cetera. So Will, we'll start with you, man. What are your thoughts on this?
What you're describing there with the black pill is nihilism. So guys who don't actually think that there's anything worth fighting for or dying for. And if they're in that state of mind, it's difficult for them to really show any kind of courage. I think Aristotle said that, you know, praise for bravery is contingent on justice. We care what someone is facing danger for. You don't really show fortitude if you're just a guy who likes base jumping, or if you're someone who likes doing lots of drugs and pushing it to the limit, so maybe you're about to overdose. The fortitude is related to showing courage in the face of like a noble death originally. And it doesn't have to be death, it's just noble causes. And unless a guy really believes that there's something that it's worth taking those risks for and committing to, then where's he going to show it in his life? Men will often seek out danger just for the sake of it, because they know it's important as a man to show that kind of quality in yourself. But then it becomes just recklessness, right? Foolhardiness, where you're just doing dangerous things for the sake of it. So, I mean, part of what we do on this podcast is try to connect guys to the deep roots of patriarchy and family and give them a bigger sense of purpose beyond just themselves. And that's why we're here week to week. And I think that's the best answer to the black pill. It's showing that these things are objectively true, good, beautiful, and worth putting that effort into.
Yeah, one thing you notice a lot when you look with any depth into the lives of professional athletes, whether they're American professional, you know, pop celebrity basketball, football types, or pro celebrities, you know, MMA athletes, or some of the lesser known pros, they're always ruled by their wives. And, you know, even since the death of Kobe Bryant, probably best thing that can happen to his legacy, who is an overlooked great, probably number two all time. And he wasn't getting any propers until he died. So that's good that he got his propers. But everyone's forgotten. I mean, he was trying really hard, spending every hour to prop up women's basketball. And many of these guys will outright admit, if you listen to the big hulking dudes in the NFL, that they're afraid of their wives. Even Mel Gibson and Joe Rogan, too. Kind of manly, strong dudes that have been in fights and things you would associate with masculinity. Both say, you know, you let your wife or your girlfriend win arguments. So it doesn't matter what sport you're talking about. The most, this just substantiates what Will was saying about courage. Base jumping isn't based. You have to be courageous in the face of something that's meaningful, not meaningless. And it's something that's consistently disappointing. The most muscled athlete out there, typically the second you stray onto the topic of marriage and family, like, oh yeah, happy wife, happy life. You're like, the muscles are meaningless. They're just show muscles, bro.
Yeah. It's disordered, right? I mean, it's okay. You're achieving a semblance of natural virtue that only has a natural end. There's nothing that really comes from that besides bigger muscles. And I've always said that, you know, if that's all you gain from training or whatever your, you know, physical aspirations are, then you sort of miss the forest for the trees. If you can't remain, you know, fortuitous in your home with your wife, then you've completely lost the plot and you've missed the point. And Will, you said something, you say a lot of great things about marriage on Twitter, but you said that, you know, you could have a six pack and make six figures and do all these great things and still have a completely dysfunctional, disordered home because A, you're not leading your wife, or you're not protecting them from your children, or you have absolutely no spine whatsoever with her, which is kind of like missing the point of all of these things, right? And I was entrenched in secular fitness culture, quote unquote, for a long time. And I looking back, I said, man, outside of this one place where I had a high degree of mastery in, I was completely effeminate. It was like, how chiseled are my abs? How much weight am I lifting? But I had absolutely no control over my concupiscible appetite. It completely ruled me. And in fact, I would say in a lot of ways, being in the gym kind of inflamed that to a degree as well. Nick, to add on to what, you know, Will and Tim were saying about this, what do you think?
I didn't know for a long time that fortitude was the primary gift of the Holy Spirit. I think we're getting a bit of an echo from you, Mike. And when I learned that, I was very surprised. I would have assumed that it was something like peace or joy or charity or some level of like faith, like spiritual enlightenment sort of thing. I expected all of those things. Fortitude really surprised me. And when I learned that, I started praying daily for fortitude. Because as you kind of quoted, I realized that basically everything I was struggling with can be overcome by virtue that I didn't have. So like, could I please just have the one virtue that'll help me do all the other hard things? You say in What a Woman Is, Mike, that we've romanticized dying in a crusade, you know, putting on armor and going out and fighting these great battles as men. But what we really need to romanticize is like patriarchy and loving one woman well our whole lives through all stages till we die. And that's way harder. And then you go on to say that marriage is slow martyrdom. And I have been married for like 30 seconds. And it's already something that has called upon my growth as a man more than the 7 documentaries that I've made around the world, you know, on no money, the tech companies I've started, the hardships I've been through, all pale in comparison to just trying to be like a better man, to just conquer my own vice, basically. So I've been disagreeable with respect to fitness, both when I was not in it actively and even now as somebody who, you know, really is pursuing a lot of Olympic weightlifting goals. It's just so banal compared to just being conquering that vice? Like, are you patient? Do you get irritated over small things? Like, are you moving toward greater holiness with your family? Because as I joke with you, like, number go up so that number can go up. Like, you know, I hit a squat and I asked my coach, I'm like, oh, that's great. How long do you think before I can hit this number? And then it really quickly turns into nihilism for me when I was like, okay, so like if I train really hard for a long time, I might get to 70% of what Mike and Will deadlift. Maybe if I don't like injure my spine sometime in the next 8 years. And Mike, when I was talking to you about it, you were like, maybe I'll deadlift 805 to 815 this year. And I'm like, okay, so it never ends. It really, truly never ends.
Yeah, it never does. And that's why it must be well-ordered. And I know this might sound, you know, maybe a little weird and cheesy, but, you know, I remember seeing a video of Will praying the Psalms in between lifting, or something like listening to Gregorian chant, or something like just, you know, crossing yourself before a lift. And really, and this might sound really Protestant, but like inviting God into the process with you and being intentional about that. Because it used to be where, you know, I had a bad gym session. And when you're almost 15 years into it and you're natural, somebody asked, it was Joshua Charles on Twitter, was like, does it really take a year to put 5 pounds on a lift? I said, yeah, when you're not on performance enhancing drugs, it is a painfully slow, and you have to be somewhat creative and incredibly consistent with not just training, but with also sleep and nutrition and everything else. And without it, it's just a meaningless idol. However, when you invite God into the process, it's such a, like, I marvel at creation. The more I grow in my faith, the fact that our bodies can make these types of physical adaptations, neurological adaptations over time in this way is remarkable. And so when a training session does not go as well, like I've kind of coming out of it now, but I've been going through an extended period of time where my body just hurts. Like, you know, I feel like I'm getting older. I put a lot of miles on the clock with training. So numbers were sort of down compared to where they were before. But with this sort of invitation of God in the process, making it sort of a movement meditation with God as sort of another prayerful activity, I don't really care what I'm lifting, because I know if God so wills, I'll come out of the other side stronger or not, but still bringing glory to Him regardless. And Will, what's been your experience? You've had a slew of, because there's, I'm going to be touching on sort of physical fortitude and its importance in building actual fortitude. But, you know, you've gone through a string of injuries and some fairly catastrophic ones. Like, what's grounded you through that process? Because you benched 440, I believe you squatted 600 plus, and six, and you've deadlifted 700 plus at a low body weight, lifetime drug free. What's that been for you?
So first, I want to say that, you know, the church doesn't teach that guys have to lift to get to heaven. So I'm not making any claim like that. But I think it is important as an easy way for guys to expose themselves to difficulty and just develop a habit of enduring hardship. So if you get attached to the process of it, just saying things like, I'm going to show up and just do my sets and reps and stay quite detached from what my performance on the day might be, whether it's great, whether it's bad, I'm not going to freak out about it. I'm just going to commit to showing up. What you're doing there is actually cultivating some of the most important parts of fortitude. And the ones that don't get talked about much because they're not sexy, it's stuff like persistence, endurance, patience. I think these are listed out as like the integral parts of fortitude. If you look at the way that Aquinas analyzes the virtue, the toughest part of fortitude is really the endurance. Like, how long can you stick at something? It's not having some spike of aggression where you go on the attack just for a couple of seconds. He actually says that's easier. The endurance over the long term, that's the tough thing. And that's what I was thinking of when Nick was talking about marriage being one of the main vehicles for the development of fortitude. And Tim was saying as well that you can have these guys who might be great in like a 3-4 second play demanding extreme aggression on the football field. But when it comes to decades of standing up to your wife, for example, and saying no, upholding boundaries and leading in the family. They're pushovers because they haven't got the endurance. So for me, whether it's like I had a 120-pound dog run into my knee about 30 miles an hour and I couldn't walk properly for a couple of months. That was bad. I've come off a mountain bike, completely separated one shoulder. The bone was almost coming out. All those ligaments are all torn still. And I was thinking at the time, well, might not be able to bench press again. But I thought, well, I'll just show up and see and just use the empty bar. And then my goal after that, because my son saw that injury and it was bad. He talks about the memory still. I was thinking, well, wouldn't it be cool if I could get my bench into the low 400s again, just to show him, not for myself, but to show him, like, if you just stick at it, you can come back. And that's the goal. Hopefully it will happen this year at some point, and that would be great, God willing. But it's more about just sticking with it and being patient. And like I said, not overreacting to bad moments or good moments, and just that consistency in so many areas of life. That's what's important.
That humiliation that comes with an injury and then being like 40% weaker and 50% weaker is good for you. Is really, really, really good for you. And I've experienced this time and time again. Go ahead, Nick.
Just the Augustine quote from, I guess, last week, maybe whatever Will's one was, where like the degree of their suffering was an indication of the degree of their idolatry. If I, like, if it is actually really humiliating that your squat goes from 600 to 300 or from 600 to zero and you can't walk, like, I don't know, that seems a little worrisome spiritually to me.
Yeah, too attached to it.
Cause like when I started lifting again after a couple years of being sedentary, just working, like a filmmaker's job, a tech guy's job is this. I sit at a desk in front of a computer, and I was getting to, through courtship, and I was going to get married. And I was like, I want athleticism. I don't want even to be the strongest guy or even to be the most physically attractive man. I want athleticism, which is to say that anything that I might have to do or be as a husband or a father, I want it to be easy for me. That was what I was pursuing when I came back to the gym. Just make it all really easy. I don't want to get winded doing anything that I would have to do over the next few years. I want to feel really good in my body, carrying babies and walking with families and moving houses and all that kind of stuff. You're I achieved that in the first 2 months. What's that?
Carrying babies around for 9 months?
Yeah. Yeah, holding them right here.
You guys have seen my leopard print sling, yeah?
Changing diapers. All the diapers are going to be changing.
See, if you Zoomers keep saying we are pregnant long enough, you're going to actually start being able to carry them in your
in our kangaroo pouches.
It's she is pregnant, kids out there listening. She is pregnant.
But like I achieved that right away, you know, 2 months in. It's not hard to like get back to that sort of level of conditioning. And so if your goals are past being like a physically capable man, like I always try. I mean, Will, you say what's new isn't true. Like gyms were invented in the 1960s after the creation of Mr. Olympia from Joe Weider, who plucked Arnold Schwarzenegger out of Austria, greased him up and put him on stage. All right. And then your ab machines and your Jenny McCarthy workout videos and your 24-hour Planet Fitness subscriptions are downstream from that. They're 60 years old or less. So if your goals are beyond being a reasonably attractive, reasonably athletic spouse, then yeah, you're probably going to feel like humiliation when that idol that you've made gets smashed on the ground because you tear something.
Ripperger made a really good point. I heard a talk about fasting, and he says, you know, so many people that fast are obsessed and thinking about how they're going to break their fast. And he goes, all of a sudden, as soon as you sort of descend into sort of that state of mind, you've lost all the graces and merit that comes with the fast, because the point of it is holy indifference. And that's an impossibly difficult thing to develop. And so I've started fasting on Sundays, and without thinking so much about, you know, if I'm going to eat again or when I'm going to eat again. And it's interesting when I go and, you know, take communion and I'm hungry and I'm not so much thinking about that. I'm trying to stay more prayerful and mindful. The hunger sort of flatlines, and it's no longer difficult. It's a way harder pursuit for me to sort of detach from lifting in that sense, because so much of it has been, my identity has been built around it. So you're absolutely right that humiliation is a symptom of an attachment, and the whole point of becoming a saint is having none of these attachments. So it's a hard balance to strike. I still haven't fully gotten all the way there with that yet, or, you know, with work, for example. But, you know, as we pray for the graces to, you know, understand that it's not about these things. God's not going to ask me how much I deadlift when I account for my life and how I led my family. But nevertheless, so the next thing is, so I know we've talked about physical training, but how does the modern Catholic man tangibly build fortitude? I know it's easy to get into the David Goggins sort of just do harder things, which really just becomes kind of like the pagan Adonis cult worship of the body that I think ultimately were bodybuilding's origins came from. What are some of those things for guys? Because I know a lot of guys that listen to us, they love what we have to say, but I know some dudes, I know for me too, it's like, you really got to spell it out for me and like hold my hand. Like, how do I do it? Like, how do I develop this virtue? Like, bullet points, say it like I'm five. Tim, hey, I challenge you to say anything. Like somebody's five, because I don't know if you can. Just kidding. Go ahead.
I didn't hear what you said the last.
I said you probably find it very difficult to explain anything like anybody's five, because your brain is just galaxy brain.
No, I would say harder things publicly. That sometimes it's easier done than said. I know a lot of. No, I don't know a lot of Catholic guys that run their household. Outside of you guys, there are only a few. but I know some Catholic guys through the TLM that do run a non-feminist household. There's like 1-2% of us out there, but they don't say it. They're not willing to say it. And in this case, it's easier done than said. To just do. Say it at your work, say it at the water cooler, talk openly and freely, make jokes with joy, with a full heart again, and being, you know, make jokes, which are always at the cost of some victim class. I mean, that's what funny jokes are anyway. Bring back good jokes. I mean, for one thing, you know, the word, I don't know, like, rhymes with hag, that you know, with a letter beginning the word close to H in the alphabet, and like retard, those have been brought back. That's a really good development. We need to bring back all the words that have been X'd out from the language. We need a right wing that's, aside from smut, which should always be censored, you know, we need a no censorship culture. And what I'm talking about when I reference the guys that I know, pro athletes, friends of mine that are just legitimately afraid of their wives, is they're really afraid to even share their podcast lists with their wives. If they're listening to CMask, they're literally like, I can't let her see that. It's the most pathetic thing I've ever seen. So the mouth, as some of the great saints have said, some of the great monastics were the first ones following Saint Anthony to take, like, I think feast day was yesterday, to take oaths against speech, all speech. The mouth is a quick way to hell, a quick form of, you know, cultivating lots and lots of vice. It's also a quick way to test your mettle for fortitude. And I know you hear every other thing, because in the completely upside down wasp culture, Anglo-Saxon culture we've been raised in, it's the opposite. They're like, work really hard, self-reliance is gay. It contradicts the equidity, the specific difference of a human being. We're social animals, and one of the proper accidents is we're rational animals, and therefore we're social animals. So no one's self-reliant. Like, stop. And basically, words aren't needed to say anything. I'm thinking of a quote from Dostoevsky where he said, if I'd only said a little bit more, this is, you know, the great one, the great novelist of all time, perhaps I could have converted more hearts. But, you know, the tragedy that could be avoided if only a little more had been said. So I think just undoing WASPism, white Anglo-Saxon Protestantism, which is a kind of baptized Enlightenment thought. It's just really toxic. And learning that what you say can actually set a kind of example for yourself, a standard for yourself, where you're like, I was talking tough. And I talk tough at the water cooler, even though normally I've been really, really a weenie about lowering my voice. If I say anything approximating what I actually believe, I work for a major corporation and they're woke. So say it. You just set the standard for yourself. Remember that time I did it? Maybe this guy is basically browbeat and henpecked at home by his wife. And he's like, well, I did that at the water cooler. I said what I really thought, even though my boss's office was right around the corner and several people that aren't close friends had cubicles nearby. Maybe I'm just going to be honest in front of my wife. And you say honestly things about feminism in front of your wife. And next thing you know, people are coming up to you and talking to you, saying, I heard you say this. It was really interesting. One time I was on a train to present a philosophy paper at the American Philosophical Association in Chicago, train from California to Chicago. And you get sat with strangers in the dining car. So it was me and Steph. And there was like a blue-haired freak woman or whatever, and some elderly Chicago statesmen. They weren't together, but they were seated on the same side of the table across from me and Steph. And the blue-haired lady started talking some shit. I forget what it was. And I was like, actually, let's go through. She said something about like the American dream, like none of us can achieve it. And I was like, hold up. Let's assess some of your premises. And I just went through. I was like, so the four of us are four very different looking people. Some maybe gay man from Chicago, well-to-do. You, some, you know, weird bio-Leninist freak. Me and Steph, just like a Catholic couple from California. And all of us, we have the Rocky Mountains, the sun setting on the Rocky Mountains over here. All of us having a nice meal together. We all disagree with one another, but we have this nice meal. And we all have the ability to travel like 1,500 miles over the course of 2 days on this nice train. Don't tell me, strictly speaking, that the American dream was always a sham. I mean, maybe it's been bankrupted or mortgaged rather by this class or that class. I can get that. But don't tell me it's strictly speaking false or that it's strictly speaking dead. And then like the Chicago guy, who was obviously Chicago lib, started pushing back. And the blue-haired freak chick was like being converted, and she got her freak husband, who was at some rally, on the phone. She's like, you have to listen to this. Then the next day I was just in the viewing car, and some guy that had been seated like 8 feet over here was like, hey man, I'm a Hollywood screenwriter. I'm a crypto conservative in Hollywood, you know, cause we took off from Union Station in LA. He's like, that's amazing. You know, you have to speak like that. People don't speak like that loudly. He's like, you have a loud voice. You tend to speak loud. And so many people were hearing the sense in what you're saying, everyone but the old Chicago guy. And so the point is, there are listeners that need to hear that. So all this bullshit about don't talk about politics and religion, not within an earshot of people who might hear it, that WASPism has controlled the narrative. And so people have just, it's aided in the censorship that abounds everywhere. And it just means that people are hearing like feminism and transsexualism in their like My Little Pony cartoons and everywhere else, and they never hear any pushback. So even reasonable, maybe cowardly souls are just like, this must be true, because the conservatives would be pushing back if it were false. So speaking the truth is actually a major, major shortcut to becoming brave. Then you're used to like whatever happens, you know, That's true fortitude, is I'm going to do the right thing no matter what follows. And speaking loudly, not speaking quietly and carrying a big stick. That's Protestant bullshit. Speak loudly and speak true. That's a quick way in today's information-run society to get fortitude.
There's a line in Joseph Pieper's book on the virtues that reminded me of, Tim. I love it. He says that the virtue of fortitude protects a person from loving his life in such a way that he loses it. Protects a person from loving his life in such a way that he loses it. If you're too attached to your job, for example, and you're afraid to speak the truth, then you end up living on your knees, right? In a way that means you lose your life.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a kind of pride of life applied to all the accoutrements of life.
Yeah, exactly.
Tim, that's such a good point. You know, a lot of us emphasize, you know, physical training, which is obviously important. I think it's really easy to show up for an hour, 90 minutes or whatever, and show up to the gym or shoot hoops or sprint or do MMA than it is to actually go around and have, when it's necessary, difficult conversations, especially with family, especially with your wife, and in small and in seemingly like insignificant ways too. You know, I'll kind of give an example of my life is, let's say I'm in a conversation with, you know, family, and somebody says that Jesus is just a prophet. Like, am I just going to cower and capitulate because it's an uncomfortable conversation to have with family? Or am I, I'm going to say, well, no, you know, I don't have to swear or be abrasive. You know, Jesus is God. That's a sort of a little example of something like that where it makes, you know, it creates enough discomfort where most people just wouldn't have that conversation, where we should be pushing in to conversations like that. And this is what has drawn me so much to you guys, because you just didn't care. You just don't care. And you'll just say what needs to be said. And what I've noticed is men respond really favorably. Even the guys that are like initially burned by what is said, they respond really favorably to that. In my men's group, there was a lot of guys just like pussyfooting around and, you know, not showing up to meetings, sometimes showing up to meetings, and they're just waffling. So my partner Brian and I, we put together an email just absolutely scolding them and calling them out, essentially calling them weak. That same meeting, we got like 40%, 50% more guys to show up. And it's like that, it reminds you of that Spider-Man meme in a way, like all the Spider-Men are just kind of pointing at each other. Men are like waiting for other men to have these conversations for them, instead of having the conversation for themselves and rallying the troops, if you will. You know, the amount of DMs and messages and comments that I get, I'm sure you guys get, with the work that we're doing for CMAS kind of speaks to that. So many guys are kind of in this corner, you know, maybe lifting some weights or doing the MMA stuff, but like not having difficult conversations because essentially they're, as Will, you know, says, you know, spiritually gay for pay. They're living on their knees because of their job. That's a really good point, Tim. It's have the hard conversations, do the hard things, but especially have the hard conversations.
If you're avoiding a difficult conversation in your life, then you're not fortitudinous. If there's anything you know that anybody in your life needs to hear and you're avoiding saying it, number one way in the modern world, you just proved you don't have fortitude. Sorry, Will.
No, sorry. I was going to say something similar. I was going to give a quick list of topics because Mike was asking for specifics for some of these guys who want it spelled out. Probably in order of like ascending difficulty to discuss, I might even have to leave the top one off. So start speaking out against greed or avarice, right? In economics, like a guy who thinks that the best job for him is always the one that's going to give the biggest salary, or just question consumerism. That already is going to be a hot conversation in a lot of families and friendship circles. Okay. So something to do with money. Start there. Next one, greed, okay? And you might even, don't even have to say anything. Just turn down dessert, right? Just say, oh, not for me today, right? I don't need it. And then that might start off some conversations too. The next one, if you're feeling ready for it, you can talk about sexual deviance, right? You don't approve of homosexuality. Just don't. You think it's disgusting. see where that goes, right? That's another topic. If you want to take it up a notch, and at this point, you're probably in getting fired territory in some jobs. If the sexual deviance one didn't take you there already, feminism, okay? So women can't be leaders in any capacity. And if you're thinking about marriage in particular, the man's the head of the household. That's pretty tough. I'd put that on a maybe joint level with stuff about race too. And then the next level up, it's the sort of stuff that E. Michael Jones talks about. That's that's probably the level of difficulty on an ascending scale. So start at a level that stretches you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, extremely well said, dude. I mean, I'm encountering this funny conversation. You guys have 7 kids, and I'm about to have, God willing, my 3rd in July. And this conversation has already come up. And this is kind of one of those examples of talking against contraception and that whole, you know, mentality. But, you know, people are like, are you going to stop? Like, that poor lady. Like, so what's your plan? And it's like, well, we're always open to life and we don't contracept. And like the look of shock and horror on people's faces, because it convicts them. And that's a good thing, right? Quoting you again, Will, first it hurts and then it heals. Like, these types of conversations, so, so necessary in a culture that's so anti-family, but not just anti-family, above that, it's like anti-Christ. And so on the talking more specifically about Christian men, I made a video about this that actually our friend Matt Frad reposted on his page on YouTube, which was pretty cool. I was talking about Andrew Tate and the state of sort of modern masculinity. And so I have a point here. Neglecting physical fortitude in favor of piety is thinly veiled sloth. We know physical training is only of some value compared to the spiritual life, but physical prowess, even as St. Paul says, and I think it was in Timothy, there is some value to be had there. Like, Christian dudes, it's actually not that hard to be more impressive than a guy like Tate. Speak difficult truths, lead your family virtuously, like live a holy sacramental life, but like, don't be fat and weak. Like, I can't believe that we have to say it. There's so many guys who are like, I'd rather be, you know, look at the saints, where any of the saints jacked. It's like, it's not the point. If you're a saint, this conversation is not for you. Like, why are you listening to C-Mask if you're a saint already? Most of you guys aren't. Most of you guys are overweight. You can't get your waistlines in check. And you wonder why you can't get your wives in check. You can't get your homes in check, because you're just, you're failing. But you think like doing all these consecrations and going to daily mass is like going to fill those gaps. Yes, it's the A-tier most important thing, of course. But like, you're slothful, you're weak. Tate has just filled this void because we've become so unimpressive as men. We become such poor examples of how to actually evangelize or be leaders. Like, dude, like, learn to fight. Like, don't be fat. You don't have to be chiseled and ripped and the strongest guy alive, but just be physically impressive and even more spiritually impressive. I don't know why this is so difficult and why this falls on deaf ears in like the normie Catholic crowd. I have no idea, and it's endlessly frustrating.
But when we get the crowd is feminist, and sorry, but that extends to basically everyone, almost everyone right outside this little circle here. And then the Groypers don't have the feminism thing happening. They have some of the debilities specific to their generation, but they don't have the ones specific to, you know, Gen X and boomers. Most other people do. So they're kind of, it's kind of like this group. And then the people that listen to maybe NJF and EMJ, they don't have it, but pretty much everyone else does. But here's the thing. The red pill guys all have it. You notice I did a kind of debate thing with Aaron Clary and Paul Elam, and Andrew Wilson was kind of on my side. Those are the men going their own way guys. And they're like, hey, look, you know, get a girlfriend, let her work, you know, you'll have 2 incomes. So they're cucked on that. This is supposed to be the cutting edge against feminism. And they're like, yeah, get your girlfriend in the workforce, pimp her out, do that. Myron Gaines just yesterday from Fresh and Fit tweeted about a woman in combat. He's like, great for her that she met some goal that was probably stretched, so to let like a girl make it. But our fighting force is still weakened, to be politically correct. Keep women out of combat. He didn't say out of the military or sports. Keep women out of sports. Keep women out of the military. Keep women out of politics. Just combat. I mean, they're progressives. The red pill guys are not cutting edge in the first place. It's not like they're cutting edge and they're saying true stuff, but they're saying it mean and in a crass way. They're progressives, and they're all for, whether it's red pill or men going their own way, they're feminist. Side point. Yeah.
No, that's a great point. I feel like in a lot of ways we're living in Nero's Rome, where like this stuff is so common, you know, women in blood sport and combat sports. And I always laugh at your reaction of how, you know, Joe Rogan and all these dudes are like, when these girls are like knocking themselves out, you're like, how absolutely like inverted and dysphoric has our culture become? And, but, you know, back to the first point, I don't know how we inspire guys to actually like do these types of things, because again, you're absolutely right. Tate is a progressive. These red pill guys are progressive despite getting a lot of these things right. I think the Groypers have some great points. It's just I don't even have the proper words to express how like insane those guys get online, despite the truths that they purport. But how do we get Catholic dudes? Say again, Tim.
I said, to be fair, people say the same shit about us. You know, all these guys get crazy.
That's fair. You know, no, that's fair. That's very fair. But
we'll besmirch anyone. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Well, how do we just get these Catholic nerds to stop being nerds? And just to put it in just plain like meathead terms, because part of building this virtue is just like, okay, you can wear a sweater vest, bro. Like, that's fine. You can be well studied on theology, and that's fine. But like, just don't be a pussy.
They're offended by even you saying that. D-bat. You know?
Yeah, they'll pearl clutch so hard. Like, it's worldly language. Okay, right. But it offended you. So obviously there's a semblance of truth to that statement because of this widespread pussification of specifically Christian men. It's like no other faith outside of Catholicism has brought like the honor and dignity and love and sort of understanding of the human body more than our faith. There was that one Pius XII addressing the Italian sporting associations in the 50s who like just laid it out so plainly, and we've completely, you know, fallen away from that, probably due in part to obviously feminism, but, or the absconding father. I guess I'm just rambling here, but I don't know how we get these guys to do it, grabbing them by the necks and like shoving them in the gyms and putting like whey protein down their throats or something. But like, you know, what do we do for these guys besides just talking about it and offending them? You know, I don't know. I'm kind of at a loss.
Well, if they're in pain, and most of them are, because they're coming to you, for example, Mike, about how to get help to get out of it, like give me the steps, just drill down further into the areas in their life that they feel really discontent with. And I think a really great question is, what are you afraid of? Because fortitude is actually about the inability to face fear. That's what it comes down to. So that people have to figure out what they're afraid of and why. And the only thing that a man is supposed to fear is God. And if you are afraid of something else, really you've turned it into a miniature God for yourself. So there's a connection to idolatry there. Figure out what you're afraid of and ask yourself why. And what does that tell you about who you are as a man? And are you happy to live like that? If not, then it might be that list of topics in conversation to start speaking your mind on, right? Maybe that's the way into it. Or maybe it's just putting down the fork when it comes to dessert being served. Don't have it. Maybe it's getting the gym once a week if you think you're afraid of physical hardship. But little by little, confronting your fears, whether they're physical, psychological, emotional, whatever it is, that's the only way to do this.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. And that's exactly what I put my guys through, because I'm exclusively coaching Catholic men in the area of fitness, but it not just being just a purely secular approach to it. And I admire all those guys that reach out and like, hey dude, I'm clueless. Like, I don't know what to do. Like, I feel physically weak. I lack virtue. And so obviously this message is not for those guys that are being proactive about it, but Will, you touched on a good point there. It's the same thing you would recommend to a guy like me that's trying to get into deeper theological study. It's like, don't go read the Summa. Like, just don't try to do that. Don't go try to lift weights like 5-6 days a week. Don't jump into Aristotelian metaphysics like the first, as you're trying to understand, you know, the teachings of the church. Like, start in a way that pushes you enough out of your comfort zone where it is uncomfortable. Then over time, there is an adaptation that happens there. And that's exactly and precisely the approach I take with these guys. It's like, hey, I don't care what's optimal. I care what's like sustainable ultimately. And you know, as you sort of get through the motions and go through the motions of that, and you face this head on, no different with this dynamic with your wife, like, as you know, with your company, Will, and a lot of these conversations I've had with these men, it's like, okay, listen, like your marriage has been like this for X amount of time. So it's going to take, you know, a significant amount of time to course correct. And it's not just go and drop the patriarchy hammer on her head the next day. It's these series of changes, but that start with you and confronting the fear and building this virtue and kind of slowly over time, you know, bringing it all together. Right. So that's a brilliant point. I'm not proposing go and get into the gym and get jacked up on steroids and go lift weights 6 days a week, just like I'm talking to the meathead guy that wants to get into theology to go read the Summa. And there's a really good point to be had because a lot of guys are all or nothing. I know I am. And you really need to spell it out. It's like, dude, it's actually not weak to start slow. That's actually smart. And it's humble. It's meeting yourself where you're at and showing that humility to say, like, yeah, I can't take all this on. I'm going to fizzle out. So start slow. Work your way up. I don't care if it's the bar, if it's like 10-pound dumbbells. It doesn't matter what it is. The point is you get in motion, you start actually doing it.
Can I read Chesterton's definition of courage, fortitude? And I know all the nerds in the audience are going nuts with this one because they're like Chesterton, but he's got a really good definition and it's something. It's the main definition of fortitude. We haven't addressed it yet.
All right, man.
Courage is almost a contradiction in terms. It means a strong desire to live, taking the form of a readiness to die. He that will lose his life, the same shall save it. It's not a piece of mysticism for saints and heroes. It's a piece of everyday advice for sailors or mountaineers. It might be printed in an Alpine guide or a drill book. This paradox is the whole principle of courage, even of quite earthly or quite brutal courage. A man cut off by the sea may save his life if he will risk it on the precipice. He can only get away from death by continually stepping within an inch of it. A soldier surrounded by enemies, if he's to cut his way out, needs to combine a strong desire for living with a strange carelessness about dying. He must not merely cling to life, for then he will be a coward and will not escape. He must not merely wait for death, for then he will be a suicide and will not escape. He must seek his life in a spirit of furious indifference to it. He must desire life like water and yet drink death like wine. It's a good one. And that's what fortitude's mainly about, is the confrontation with death. And I don't really have
That's a great quote. And sort of in closing, and sort of, I guess, in humility too, I think a lot of guys have the tendency, let's say, listen to us and think sort of that we've got it all figured out, that we've maybe not gone through a high degree of hardship. Those of us that really know us and listen to a lot of our stuff, you know, obviously do. But if you guys were to list some like specific examples in your lives where this was so necessary, the fortitude was necessary, and you were challenged by it in such a way that you felt like you were going to break, but by God's grace, you were sort of able to push through and develop this, you know, the topic of discussion, which is obviously fortitude. So Nick, what are some examples in your life, bro?
No, it's an English teacher of mine said, knowledge is tied to culpability. And as soon as you know something to be true, it's your responsibility morally now to act on it. And that's something that I think that I've habituated quite well, that the moment I sort of become aware of the more correct way to do or be, I have to do it. And I was just talking to, or texting with, Tim and I's mutual friend, Scott, about this, that like, no, Christianity, nobody really understands in the secular world how much it asks of you, because you don't just want to, you're not just supposed to do the right thing. You're supposed to do the right thing and agree, submit to the fact that doing the right thing is the right thing. And then after you've gone through that pain, you're also supposed to do it with joy. And I think that's the area of fortitude that I'm struggling with the most is I know what the right thing is and I do it, but gosh, I should be way more cheerful while I do it. I understand suffering's good. I understand doing the hard things good, but I feel a tremendous lack of virtue in my ability to do it with the same kind of cheerfulness that I think is incumbent upon somebody who truly professes the things that we do. So that's where I'm struggling right now the most.
That's very, very, very relatable. And Will, how about for you?
Well, I suppose the big one would be getting fired and threatened with a lifetime ban from the teaching profession and referred to a counterterrorism unit and losing my house and income with a stay-at-home wife and five kids right before Christmas and not knowing what to do next, but deciding that there's no way I was going to stay where I was and live on my knees to an ideology that's hostile to masculinity. So that was a big one because it was about endurance and just putting one foot in front of the other and seeing where I ended up. And people at the time assumed that I must have some kind of private family fortune to be able to do that and not have some kind of breakdown over it. But really my response was that just like in that Joseph Pieper quotation, you can't love your life in a way that means you're going to lose it. And in my view, I was going to lose it if I couldn't teach with integrity, because that cuts right to the core of what masculinity is. So that's the big moment in my life where I feel like I've been tested most, just in an acute sense, right? A big crisis to go through that took a while to figure out. And then just the daily test of fortitude as well, in the sense of endurance, of just making the effort to lead a large family without my wife working outside the home in a world that is very hostile to that and does everything it can to try and make men believe it's not possible, even from the way the tax system is structured. So it incentivizes having a wife who works outside the home because you get massive benefits from doing that. They're trying to suck you into it and just believing that there is actually a way to get it done. Even if you can't see it sometimes, you just keep pushing and trust that you can have confidence in God and it is possible because he doesn't ask us to do things that are impossible. So that brings out all kinds of weakness in me day to day, exposes that in the surface. And that's a good thing. You need to find that in yourself and face it down, grind it out of yourself.
That's super well said, Will. How about you, Tim?
I think it's family life in conjunction with the confrontation with death that I think constitutes the truest fortitude. It's, you know, began for us. We have seven kids with our first daughter, Abigail, when I lived in Rome and was studying there, and several brain surgeries there made me, as a young man, confront a young, healthy man who had really never had any young people, known any young people who had any major health problems, confront it right there with my first daughter, because Steph had to have an emergency C-section. All of our following children would have to be C-sections, meaning there's a mini confrontation with death there. Abby would have ongoing brain surgeries and eventually have one half of her brain essentially removed, you know, when she was older. Confrontation with death there, just a constant daily reminder that the bigger you, the more you grow your family, you know, well, you have seven kids too, the better it is for you and everyone in the family. The bigger the family, the more virtue it takes just to live together in a household of, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12, you know, and lots of people. It's just the less selfish it makes you. And that's beautiful and that's good. And that's the kind of natural virtue I have always gelled with easily. What's hard is how much you love them, not also growing linear to the amount of children you have, because there's that amount of love that just grows, but kind of burgeoning pride of life, especially when you have one kid that needs constant attention. And so It's just scary. It's scary to love your family as much as you do and to not really have any control over your eldest daughter's health or really any of your health. So the daily confrontation with building fortitude comes for a special form in the household, the lay patriarch householder guy. To whatever extent you actually really, really love your family, you just don't want to be separated from them. And of course, for me, it's circumscribed by the psychic scar tissue, what happened with our firstborn. And, you know, Steph's been through 6 C-sections. We thought she was pregnant the last 2 weeks with number 8. Turns out she's not. But you're just always giving it to God. Like, okay, if she's pregnant, she's going to have her 7th C-section with number 8. Then, you know, just protect her. Whatever, that will be done. That will be done. To acknowledge you're not really in control is the scariest thing. And, you know, hopefully I'm getting a little better at that. I'm fine at cultivating the natural virtues, but that one seems to be, in the words intoned by Chesterton, the almost supernatural virtue that just requires otherworldliness in probably in the realm of the supernatural virtue of faith.
Yeah. That's a great point, Tim, about the confrontation with death, because it comes back to the way that Aristotle talks about fortitude. And I was thinking as you were saying that, that for guys who really want to see fortitude, sometimes the best place is going to be in like a hospital for sick kids rather than a gym full of meatheads, right? In terms of the long-term confrontation with it and not letting your spirit get broken, that's one of the best places you can see the real spirit of fortitude.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that's all great. That's amazing stuff, guys. I guess for me, I mean, there's been battle with addiction and promiscuity and living without a father and the identity crisis that comes with that and the turbulence in life that comes with that. But the biggest challenge for me was when I moved here. And I decided to put my family on my back and leave everything behind, where I was always known as the guy that would never leave that little circle of East Vancouver that I came from. And from like mid 2022 until the end of 2023, I was essentially wrecked with suicidal ideation. I wanted to die. It wasn't like, maybe. No, like I wanted to die. I didn't have it in me. It was my daughter and my wife that gave me that little shred, and God's grace, of course, above all, but that gave me that bit of hope that, okay, I'm going to reach the other end of this highway that I'm on that seems endless. And I handled it very poorly. I drank a lot. I wasn't a good husband. I wasn't a good father. You know, I had some semblance of faith, praise God. And, you know, now looking back with the perspective that I have was moving here was the greatest decision of my life. There was this purging, this purgation that happened to me throughout that process that, in hindsight, had I not done that, I don't think I would have become Catholic. I don't think my family would have received all the sacraments and the graces that we've received last year. Last year was the greatest year of my entire life. And I think that was no coincidence, because I've dealt with suicidal ideation before. I've stayed over a weekend in a brief intervention unit, which was like a psych ward. I've seen the depths and the ends of myself with addiction and all these things. But nothing tested my mettle with that, having a falling out with my in-laws and going from Airbnb to Airbnb while this house was getting built, having to rebuild a 6-figure income, my wife at the time still working from home. And so, and then all of a sudden, just as the grace, you know, I pushed through that. I knew that there was going to come a time where this would clear, not exactly knowing when, but this grace that just dropped from above that made me to start to inquire about my Catholic history. And then 2024 came, and it was the best year financially, best year faithfully, best year familially. You know, there are multiple miscarriages that happened, a couple that happened along the way. And, you know, I'm sober now and all of these things. But I legitimately wanted to die. And if it wasn't for this like shred of fortitude that I had through that time, and grace and faith in God, that would not have been possible. And that was like I hate to think about further challenges that come down the pike, but that was a furnace of fiery trial for me. And I'm obviously glad I didn't pull the trigger and send myself to perdition, but by God's grace. And, you know, it's funny because how this all kind of came around to when we started CMask as well. It was in those last couple of months. I felt like I was finally getting back on my feet. And yeah, everything that followed from that was, you know, then retiring my wife. She's never working again. She's hasn't worked for, you know, the last year and a half, you know, praise God for that. And of course there's more challenges that come along the way, but clinging to that grace and clinging to this idea that, you know, what are the sub virtues here? I have them written down. There's magnanimity, equanimity, magnificence, longanimity, perseverance, patience, and mortification. And all of them are inextricably linked to one another. And those are all the sub virtues of fortitude. So that's what we all have in common. That's why we're here talking together. And I think this has been a tremendous conversation. I hope it's been edifying for the listeners as well. And I want to end with a quote by St. Augustine. Fortitude is the disposition of soul which enables us to despise all inconveniences and the loss of things not in our power based. So I don't know if you guys have any last closing thoughts, but that's it for now for me. What do you guys say?
EBAP. Help you pussy. This should be the guiding principle in the schoolyard as a man gets older. Like, you just want to not be scared. And you want to have fortitude. It's simplistic, but we have to go back to saying DBAP.
There's a really nice old prayer that I get the guys who I help in their marriages to think about. It goes like this: Almighty God, give me the cheerful strength to lift the burden of troubled hearts from the members of my family without vexing them with the burdens that are mine. Amen. It's old Jesuit
prayer. Who is that from?
Just an old Jesuit prayer. I don't know who wrote it specifically, but I found it. I just love it. Almighty God, give me the cheerful strength to lift the burden of troubled hearts from the members of my family without vexing them with the burdens that are mine.
Can you send that in our chat, Will? That sounds like a St. Ignatius of Loyola quote. It sounds like something he would say.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's a beautiful one. Well, gentlemen, this was a great conversation. I hope it edifies everybody that listened. God bless all of you. I will not be here next Friday. I'm traveling, so it'll just be the three of you stooges. I will miss you guys. But until we meet again, God bless you, all three of you, and everybody listening.
God bless, guys. Take care.